Good day and welcome to this Clinical Update Infectious Disease Perspective conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. For opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the call over to Ms. Denise Faulkner-Cameron. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. We'd like to welcome you to this, our 10th call as part of the Jenny Statewide Collaborative Call. The topic of today's call is a clinical update from the infectious disease perspective. For those of you who joined us last week, our call was from the cardiac perspective, where we discussed the AMI and chronic heart failure topics. So this morning, we will be discussing the two infectious disease topics, which include surgical infection prevention and pneumonia. Our featured guest this morning is Dr. Edward Chapnick, but before I introduce him, I would like to give everyone an opportunity to log on to our Jenny website to access today's conference call materials if you have not already had a chance to do so. The website, again, is Jenny, Jenny, J-E-N-Y, .ipro.org. Give everyone a few seconds to do so, to log on. And when you get to the main website, if you'll just click on conference calls, and then click on the link that's labeled February 24, 2005, conference call materials. You'll see a message from me, and attached are three documents. The first two are the slide presentations that Dr. Chapnick will cover, and then the last is the evaluation form, and we'll just go over a reminder for the evaluation form at the end of the call. After Dr. Chapnick's presentation, we will open the lines up for questions and answers. At this time, I'd like to introduce our speaker, Dr. Edward Chapnick, who is the Director of Infectious Disease at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. He is a graduate of the State of New York Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn. And he is affiliated with a number of medical societies, professional societies, including the American Society of Microbiology, Infectious Disease Society of America, and the Brooklyn Infectious Disease Society. In addition to his many other credentials, Dr. Chapnick is the recipient of several awards, including Phi Beta Kappa Honor Society, the Resident of the Year for the Department of Medicine at Maimonides Medical Center, and he is also the author of several publications. We're very pleased to have Dr. Chapnick with us, and at this time, I would like to turn the call over to him. Dr. Chapnick?
Thank you, and I'd like to first of all wish everyone good morning and start by thanking Ms. Faulkner-Cameron and Dr. Stimler for the opportunity to present this conference. Basically, what I was asked to do this morning was discuss the perspective of an infectious diseases physician as we were going through the implementing the performance measures related to pneumonia and to surgical infection prevention. And a few basic points I wanted to make was, first of all, you know, as we go through these performance measures, they look very straightforward, very simple. And I'm sure many of you have seen what we've seen at Maimonides, and that is as we start to work through the performance measures and implement them, we've seen that there are gray areas involved in implementing these, and I'm going to highlight them as we go along. I think it's also important to realize that when these gray areas are identified, they can be addressed. We've had a very good dialogue with individuals at IPRO related to areas that we weren't entirely sure about and things that we weren't entirely sure how to go forward. So it's important to realize there are people to speak to. This group in particular is very helpful. And also speaking to individuals at IPRO when problems come up is very helpful. Additionally, in this one, I probably shouldn't have to state specifically, but I think it's important to, when we're talking about the care of individual patients, not every patient or the appropriate treatment for each individual patient doesn't always fall exactly into the performance measures. And it's important to realize that obviously the most important point is to take proper care of the patient in front of you, whether or not that exactly adheres to a performance measure. So where we're going to start, is with the slide set that's labeled I-prone pneumonia. And the first slide we could sort of go past, since hopefully you all know who I am already. And let's move on to project performance measure number one, which is the second slide. And that one is antibiotic timing. And the performance measure is that the initial antibiotic be given within 4 hours of hospital arrival. And this one, again, seems quite simple and quite straightforward. But in a busy emergency department, it's not uncommon for a patient with mild pneumonia who doesn't meet the criteria for triage for prompt acute therapy to wait in the waiting area for a number of hours. And it's not inconceivable that such patients don't receive their first dose of antibiotic within 4 hours of arrival. The other problems we experienced when discussing this performance measure included getting the antibiotic to the emergency department promptly once it's ordered, as well as the fact that we, as many other institutions, have a very tight antibiotic approval system. What that means is many of the medications that we use to treat these patients require approval from an ID physician before the first dose is given. So how are these particular problems addressed? And the next slide, which says prompt antibiotic administration. First of all, our ER triage staff was instructed that patients who have a diagnosis of pneumonia or rule out pneumonia would automatically be given a higher triage priority, at least to be seen by a physician. The second measure that was implemented was a pneumatic tube system from the emergency department to the pharmacy. This greatly facilitated the ability to get the medications to the patients quickly. And finally, we've implemented treatment protocols for the ED physicians. And we're now evolving to the point that ED physicians for patients with infectious diagnoses, such as pneumonia, the physician can order medications as per pneumonia protocol. And then the medications are automatically ordered for that patient. And approval by an infectious disease physician isn't required until the patient actually physically goes to an inpatient unit. Now, the next performance measure, again, one that on its face seems quite simple, and that is the selection of antibiotic agents which are consistent with current guidelines for the treatment of pneumonia. Now, the next slide lists or indicates the recommended antibiotic for community-acquired pneumonia. And these guidelines were published in 2003 by the Infectious Diseases Society of America. And these were also in conjunction with the American Thoracic Society. So these guidelines are pretty well accepted as to what agents we should be giving. The only thing I'd like to call your attention to on this slide is towards the center of the slide where it says inpatient and medical ward. Basically, the recommended treatment for a newly admitted patient with pneumonia is either a respiratory quinolone, which I'll show you what that is in a moment, or what they call an advanced macrolide plus a beta-lactam. And on the next slide, and identifies what they mean by these things. Letter D, or superscript C, excuse me, indicates that the respiratory fluoroquinolones that they're referring to are moxifloxacin or Avalox, gadifloxacin or Teclin, or levofloxacin, which the brand name is Levoquin. Of note, ciprofloxacin is not considered a respiratory fluoroquinolone for the purposes of treating pneumonia. The advanced macrolides are really referred to as anything other than erythromycin. So that would be clarithromycin, which is Biaxin, or azithromycin, which is Zithromax. And finally, the cephalosporins, which are regarded as acceptable, are indicated under H, and the specific ones are cefotaxime or ceftriaxone. The one that's used most often is ceftriaxone or rocefin. Now, what is the problem that we identified? Again, this seems quite straightforward. Well, our hospital, as I'm sure many of your institutions, is closely affiliated and receives patients from a number of skilled nursing facilities. And in our case, we have a skilled nursing facility that's right across the street, and patients are frequently transferred back and forth from the hospital to the skilled nursing facility. Now, what we found is the patients who come from this skilled nursing facility, when they get infections, those infections are very similar microbiologically to the kind of infections we see in patients in our institution. However, according to the guidelines, these patients are newly admitted from the community and should be treated as for community-acquired pneumonia. And what we were finding was, we were starting treatment with agents like vancomycin, because we have a lot of methicillin-resistant staph, as well as advanced-spectrum anti-pseudomonal drugs, because those are the kind of organisms these patients have. And as you saw from the previous slides, those treatments don't fall into the recommended treatment for community-acquired pneumonia. Now, how is this problem solved? Well, in consultation with IPRO, we arrived at the conclusion that adding a fluoroquinolone, one of those respiratory fluoroquinolones that we indicated before, would have two benefits. The first benefit would be that it would provide a second agent to cover gram-negative organisms, which is helpful to the patient. And additionally, it would provide coverage for the atypical organisms, such as Legionella. And by giving the respiratory fluoroquinolone, that meant these patients' treatment was in agreement with the guidelines for treatments for community-acquired pneumonia. We could then add on the drugs that we generally give for hospital-acquired pneumonia. And in this way, we were able to treat the patients quite appropriately and in the same way being in agreement with the recommendations from various professional societies. Let's move on to the next performance measure. Again, recurring theme. Seems very straightforward. In patients sick enough to require hospitalization because of an infectious illness, anyone, not just pneumonia, blood cultures are clearly indicated. Now, we were quite successful in getting our emergency department to obtain blood cultures promptly in patients being admitted for pneumonia, excuse me, and also we were very successful in getting them to obtain the blood cultures before antibiotics are started, which is quite important. Where we weren't so successful was getting the clinicians in the emergency department to obtain two sets of blood cultures. Now, that specific procedure is not included in the performance measure, but it's very clear from the literature that to maximize yield of these blood cultures, two separate sets should be obtained. Additionally, it's clear that obtaining one set of blood cultures is virtually never acceptable, at least in an adult, The reason being, if an organism such as Staph epidermidis that may be a contaminant or may be a pathogen is isolated, the second blood culture is essential to help interpret whether that isolate is a pathogen or not. So the harder part of this was getting the entire emergency department staff to obtain two sets of blood cultures when they obtain that one before antibiotics are started. This one has been a little harder to implement, but with continuous education programs, we have been progressively increasing the proportion of time that two blood cultures are obtained. Now, the next slide, which, by the way, is slide number 9, talks about performance measure number 4, and we're going to talk about number 4 and number 5 together, because these both relate to immunization. Now, what I say about influenza vaccination applies in years that we don't have a shortage of vaccine, because it's a little harder to implement widespread vaccination when supplies are not reliable. But in general, the IPRO performance measure talks about all inpatients having to fall into one of these categories. And the categories are either the patients have already gotten the vaccine during this current flu season, they may refuse to receive the vaccine, they may not receive the vaccine because they have an allergy or sensitivity to any vaccine components, or the vaccine is indicated and should be given. Now, in the next slide, we get into a little more detail about who should receive the vaccine. And in most years, this past year, because of shortages, the age was changed to 65, at least up until recently. But in most years, the indication for the flu vaccine is age over 50. And the others you can see are listed in this slide. Children aged 6 to 23 months should receive the influenza vaccine. And also women who will be pregnant during the influenza season, that's a clear indication to receive the influenza vaccine. Now, next is the pneumococcal vaccine. Here, the recommendations or the indications are slightly different, but the performance measure is very similar. That is, patients should either have received the vaccine previously. In this case, it's not during the current season. It's have people received it previously at all. Or patients can refuse the vaccine. They can be allergic to it. Or the vaccine should be given if indicated. Now, what are the indications for the pneumococcal vaccine? Let's just give a little background, because there are some misconceptions, especially among patients, but also among healthcare workers about this particular vaccine. It includes the types of pneumococcus that cause about 85 to 90% of the cases of pneumococcal disease in the United States. It's a very safe vaccine. There are no known contraindications. And of importance in implementing a hospital-based vaccine program is there's no significant risk for recent vaccination. As I said previously, the influenza vaccine, as we know, is given once per year. The pneumococcal vaccine, however, is given either once in a lifetime or repeated in 5 years, and we'll talk about when each of those happens. But the important point here is that patients may be admitted to the hospital and may not recall having previously received the pneumococcal vaccine. It's clear from the literature that inadvertent re-immunization does not cause an increased risk of side effects. So someone should get the pneumococcal vaccine. If they're not sure if they've received it previously, they should be immunized. So here are the indications. Chronic diseases, age over 65. Now, for children under the age of 2, those of you who either have small children or work in pediatrics, there is now a different conjugate vaccine that's safe and effective in younger children, but that's not what we're talking about for this particular purpose. Revaccination according to guidelines, should be given once at 5 years, but only in people who got their first dose before they were 65 years old. The reason for this is there just isn't any data yet on whether revaccination is indicated or is effective in individuals over the age of 65. Now, the next slide goes over what we have implemented as a way to solve this problem. We have computerized order entry in our institution, and as part of all admission order sets, the clinician must either order the pneumococcal vaccine or the influenza vaccine if it's during the season for the influenza vaccine. And the order is that the vaccine be given at discharge unless one of these four indicators are entered by the ordering clinician. So the vaccine must be indicated, that is, the patient falls into one of those categories. No contraindications such as allergy, not previously given. And, of course, if the patient refuses, it's not given. Now, why do we give this vaccine at discharge? Well, two reasons. Number one, the vaccines are most effective when given when the patient is in their best health. And we would hope that over the course of a hospital stay, the patient's condition is at their best at the time they leave the hospital. Second reason is, I said the vaccines are safe, but there can be a mild febrile reaction after the vaccine. And if this is given at the time of admission and the patient does develop this febrile reaction, it certainly can confuse the initial evaluation and management for their admitting condition. So that is the last slide in the set labeled IPRO-pneumonia. I'd like to ask you now to go to the next slide set, which is labeled IPRO-prophylaxis. And it's really out of the indicators or out of the performance measures that are in the surgical infection prevention category. The ones I am going to concentrate on are the ones that, as an infectious diseases physician, my input was sought the most in the hospital, as well as the ones that were most problematic as we went along. So let's move on to slide number two, and just a little background. I'm sure I don't have to convince you that surgical infections are a bad thing, but this particular slide demonstrates that postoperative patients who develop infections have, as we would expect, a higher mortality, more likely to need ICU care, longer length of stay, higher cost, more readmissions, et cetera. Next slide, which is number three. Also, this shouldn't be news to anyone. Surgical site infections are a common cause of nosocomial infection, either second or third, after urinary tract infections, pneumonia. Bloodstream infections, the source may or may not be established, but clearly surgical site infections are a very important and prevalent cause of hospital-acquired infection. And clearly, there's an opportunity to prevent these. It's estimated, and these estimates, of course, are not very precise, but it's estimated that about half of surgical site infections are preventable. And part of where this estimate comes from is the fact that antibiotics are not used appropriately in anywhere from 25 to 50% of patients who have surgery. And what's meant by not appropriate? It can mean using too much of an antibiotic, and we'll talk about how that can be an issue. Using not enough, giving the agent at the wrong time, or using the wrong agent. And again, this occurs in anywhere from 25 to 50% of operations, depending on the study that we're referring to. So the first quality indicator related to surgical infection prevention that I'm going to discuss is the proportion of patients who receive antibiotics within 1 hour before incision. I'm going to go through some of the data that supports this particular indicator. But many of us were sort of brought up medically in the era that patients going for surgery had antibiotics given, quote, on call, unquote, to OR. And when antibiotics are ordered in that fashion, what that means is it's given on the floor before the patient goes to the OR. And when we take into account the usual delays in terms of transport coming to get the patient, delays in the holding area, delays in the OR being ready, it was very infrequent that patients actually received the antibiotic within this one-hour preoperative time frame. But first of all, let's go through some of the data to support this. We're now on slide number six. This landmark study, which discussed the use of antibiotics prophylactically for surgery, was actually published in 1961. So this information has been known for a very long time. Previously, antibiotics had been given after surgery and weren't very effective at preventing infection, and we'll see why as we go along. This particular study looked at guinea pigs, and what was done was a surgical incision was made, bacteria were put into that incision, and then the guinea pigs were studied postoperatively to see if infection developed. And antibiotics were given at various time frames, either before or after the incision. And if we look at the graph on the next slide, the top line, the one that has the little X's in it, is the control group. Those are guinea pigs in whom an incision was made. Live bacteria was put in, and that's what the lesions look like, or the diameter of the lesions after surgery. The bottom line is sort of the negative control. That's where the incision was made and killed bacteria were put in. And there, of course, the lesions were much smaller because no infection developed. The middle line is when antibiotics were given at various time frames. And if you look at the y-axis, the number on the x-axis is minus 1. That is where antibiotics were given 1 hour preoperatively. And there, the lesions were not significantly different than those which were obtained when killed bacteria were put into the wound. That means giving antibiotics 1 hour preoperatively was essentially close to 100% effective at preventing infection. If you move now along the x-axis to the number 3, by the time the antibiotic was given 3 hours after incision time, the lesions were not significantly different as those in the control group, that is, the ones who received no antibiotics. So this clearly demonstrates that preoperative antibiotics are much more effective than antibiotics given after the surgical incision was made. This was subsequently correlated in a human study, and slide number 8, this was published in 1969, which, by the way, was a very important year, not only because we landed on the moon, but because it was the first year that the Mets ever won the World Championship. In any case, this particular study looked at the cephalosporin, cefaloridine, which is a first-generation cephalosporin, given pre-op, and it wasn't given ideally because it was given on-call versus placebo. And what was shown in this study on slide number 9 is that there were significantly fewer infections in the patients given cefaloridine than those given placebo. This study also included some post-op doses of antibiotics, by the way. And we'll get into that issue a little more as we go along also. So as you can see, the p-values were all highly significant here. The difference in the groups, first group double-blind patients, determinant double-blind means they eliminated the patients who also were treated for an infection post-operatively. That's why those numbers are a little smaller. And then all determinant patients also includes patients after the blinding code was broken. So the reason the number is higher in the cephaloridine group was once they saw there was a benefit, all patients got prophylaxis. and they then included those patients in the data where it says all determinant patients. But whichever way it's looked at, whichever group of patients is looked at, the p-values were highly significant, showing that perioperative antibiotics reduce postoperative infections. Now, this study was done in general surgery. The sort of landmark study was published in 1992, and this was done in Latter-day Saints Hospital in Salt Lake City. They looked at all scheduled elective surgery over the time period stated here. And they only looked at clean and clean contaminated operations. So the results are shown on, or the definitions are shown on slide 11. I'd like to call your attention to the 0 to 2 hours prior to incision group, which they called preoperative. And on slide 12, this graph shows pretty convincingly that the patients who got preoperative antibiotics had a much lower infection rate than any of the other groups in this study. On the next slide, it shows that the p-value is highly significant, that the group who got antibiotics in that two-hour preoperative time frame had a significantly lower risk of infection than any of the other groups. Now, other studies to support the same idea. On slide number 14, this was a large study of general surgery patients looking at risk factors for wound infection. And the ones listed here, age, wound type, et cetera, these are all things we'd expect. But the most significant factor was timing of prophylaxis. When prophylaxis was given more than 2 hours before incision, there was a 5 times greater risk of postoperative infection versus patients who got the antibiotics within that 2 hour time frame. The same holds true for cardiac surgery. This is a study of patients who had coronary artery bypass, and we're on slide number 16 now. Again, most significant risk factor, antibiotic prophylaxis given more than 60 minutes pre-op in this particular study, but a very similar odds ratio. These people were 5 times more likely to get infection. That is, those who got the antibiotics more than 60 minutes preoperatively. Now, indicator number 2, and I'm not going to get into this in any great amount of detail because the recommended antibiotics are established and published, and in most cases the recommended preoperative antibiotic is cefazolin or ANCEF. In some cases, such as allergy or a high prevalence of MRSA, then either replacement with vancomycin or addition of vancomycin could be considered. But this one actually is pretty straightforward. Now, quality indicator number 3 is the one that we had the most problems with. Now, I'm sure many of you are in a similar circumstance because many surgeons have been trained to continue perioperative antibiotics postoperatively. And as we go through the literature, we'll see there really is little or no support for that concept, although it's one that is very hard to get surgeons to change. So the quality indicator, although there's really no data to suggest that any postoperative doses of antibiotic are beneficial, the quality indicator allows antibiotics to be continued up to 24 hours postoperatively. Part of the reason for this is many of the studies were designed in this way. That is, they were designed to compare less than 24 hours post-op antibiotics to more than. But I want to reemphasize the fact that, in general, there's no data to support any post-operative antibiotics. Again, when we're discussing prophylaxis rather than treatment of infection. The next slide, which is number 20, there are several studies. I've indicated 2 of them on this slide showing that 1 day of postoperative antibiotics in orthopedic surgery is as good as either 3 days or 7 days. And many of the patients included in these studies were patients in whom prosthetic joints or hardware was inserted during surgery, because one of the arguments we hear from orthopedic surgeons is they want to continue longer to protect the prosthetic device that's put in. And again, there's no data supporting giving longer courses of antibiotics. It does not further reduce the risk of infection. Same applies to cardiac surgery. Excuse me. Two studies cited here, but there are many others. One published as far back as 1972. Antibiotic was given intraoperatively here, not preoperatively, so it wasn't optimal. But whether placebo or antibiotic was given post-op, there was no difference in wound infections. Second study, one dose of antibiotic, cefuroxime, was as good as a four-day broader spectrum regimen. And again, from what we sometimes hear from the cardiac surgeons is they want to continue longer to protect a prosthetic heart valve. Both of these studies included large numbers of patients with prosthetic heart valves. And again, continuing the antibiotics longer did not offer any decreased risk of infection of these prosthetic heart valves. Same thing in thoracic surgery. The study on slide number 22 shows one pre-op dose of cefazolin is as good as one pre-op plus five post-op doses at preventing post-op wound infection. And I could have cited many other studies that had similar results. I could not find one study anywhere in the literature that showed a benefit of continuing preoperative antibiotic prophylaxis postoperatively. So now I'm going to go through a whole bunch of guidelines. On slide number 23, this is from the Archives of Surgery, and you can read this, but I'll quote this. The shortest effective course of prophylactic antibiotics should be used. In many settings, this consists of coverage only while the patient is in the operating room. Coverage limited to the intraoperative period is one of the most significant recent changes in antibiotic prophylaxis and is dramatically different from the 24 to 48-hour coverage previously recommended. Extending the course to cover lines, tubes, and catheters is unwarranted. Next, this comes from Dr. Nichols, who's a surgeon and a real authority on perioperative prophylaxis. He talks about the risk associated with prolonging antibiotics and states the administration of additional doses during the 24 hours after the start of the operation appears unnecessary. Next, slide 25. This comes from the Infectious Diseases Society of America, Society of Healthcare Epidemiology of America, Surgical Infection Society, Pediatric ID Society, CDC, Obstetrics and Gynecology ID Society, and the Association of Practitioners in Infection Control. So lots of different alphabetical agencies here. No further benefit is conferred by the administration of additional doses after the patient has left the OR. Postoperative administration not recommended. Medical letter agrees. So basically, there is unanimous agreement that perioperative antibiotics should not be considered post-op. What's the potential harm? Well, increases in resistant organisms such as MRSA, increases in Clostridium difficile colitis, and finally, general increases in resistance. When we use antibiotics inappropriately, we have to realize we're not just hurting the patient who might develop a new resistant organism, but we're hurting potentially all the other patients in the institution because that organism clearly can be spread from patient to patient. The next slide, how do we stop postoperative prophylaxis? This has been the hard one, and the way we've been able to succeed when we have, and we certainly haven't been able to succeed anywhere close to 100% of the time with this, there have to be champions among surgeons who agree with the data and agree that postoperative or that perioperative antibiotics shouldn't be continued. And a few influential surgeons can make all the difference in the world in helping to stop this practice of continuing antibiotics. You know, some of the arguments I've been given, people will say to me, prove to me that postoperative antibiotics are not beneficial. Well, I have a lot of studies to prove that. I can prove they're detrimental. I can prove they're not beneficial. I turn this argument around and say to the question, you prove to me that they are beneficial. Show me a study. And so far, no one has been able to do so. Next, the common thing, I want to continue the antibiotics until all tubes come out. Now, Dr. Aaron Kranz in this study cited in bullet point one put this very well. This misconception is biological nonsense. I was able to find one study that shows that this practice increases the risk of developing resistant organisms colonizing those tubes. It doesn't sterilize the tubes. It just causes the bugs to be more resistant. Next argument that I've heard, I want to prevent infection of the prosthetic valve. I've already discussed this. There's data as far back as 1963 showing that perioperative or postoperative antibiotics don't prevent endocarditis of the prosthetic valve. It would be nice if they do, but they don't, and there's no data that they do. The other one is my patient has a fever postoperatively. Well, as we know, out of the four W's that can cause post-op infection, wind, that being atelectasis, wound, that being wound infection, water, that being urinary tract infection, and walk, that being pulmonary emboli, two of these, atelectasis and deep venous thrombosis and pulmonary emboli, are not infectious. And postoperative fever should be evaluated and treated with antibiotics if it's an infection. But continuing antibiotics just because of a fever in every single patient who has a fever is clearly not warranted. And finally, this is the last step people will say to me, well, if I do what you say and the patient then develops a post-op infection, it will be your fault. And that's being directed at me. Now, and I put this Alfred E. Newman saying, so what? I don't mean to say, so what, the patient developed an infection. Of course, I care about the patient developing infection. So what refers to the accusation being directed at me because it's well established in the literature that continuing the antibiotics would not have prevented this or any other infection. So how can we prevent postoperative infection? Well, one is appropriate use of perioperative prophylaxis. Other things that are included in the Surgical Infection Prevention Project, which I haven't specifically discussed because I wasn't directly involved in implementing them, but things like normal glycemia during surgery, normal thermia during surgery, various not shaving the skin preoperatively. There are numerous things that we know can help lower the risk of infection postoperatively. One of the most important, and again, I probably don't have to emphasize this with this audience, but I think we all should be emphasizing this with every audience, that is appropriate hand disinfection. I'm sure it's well known that Centers for Disease Control has said that alcohol-based disinfectants should be the preferred method of hand disinfection in hospitals, and we should continue to encourage their use. The picture on the right-hand side here is actually a picture of my daughter on her first day of kindergarten, and the reason I put it in there is because included in the list of things she was supposed to bring to school was alcohol-based hand disinfection. And if it can be done among five-year-olds, we certainly should be able to do a better job of this among ourselves. So that's basically the conclusion of my prepared remarks. And at this point, I'll certainly be glad to entertain any questions or comments.
Thank you. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key, followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. We will proceed in the order that you signal us, and we'll take as many questions as time permits. Once again, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone to ask a question. We'll go first to Margaret Purvis of New Island Hospital.
Yes, hi. There was a seminar by American Operating Room Nurses of America, and they are discussing about change in OR temperature. Can you comment something on that, please? They said that the recommendation before is no longer effective, and they want the OR temperature to go down a little bit.
Yeah, that's one I really can't comment on because I'm not familiar with the literature on how temperature correlates with post-op infections. I certainly wouldn't go against what professional societies are recommending, but I can't comment any more on that particular topic.
And can I ask one more question?
Fine with me.
Okay. How about the administration of antibiotic when the OR case is longer than 2 hours? Do you recommend that?
Right. Well, that entirely depends on the agent being given. There's no absolute answer, 2 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours. For an agent like cefazolin, which is most commonly used, it's somewhere on the order of 4 hours when repeat doses need to be given. So the subsequent doses during surgery are related to the pharmacodynamics of the medication being given and also related to the degree of blood loss. The more blood loss there is intraoperatively, obviously, the more loss of antibiotic there will be, and the earlier the dose needs to be given. But absolutely, doses should be repeated as needed for longer procedures intraoperatively. The key point is maintaining therapeutic levels from the time the skin is open to the time the skin is closed. That's the overriding principle.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We'll go next to Jean Rogers of Niagara Falls Memorial Med Center.
Yes, Dr. Chapnick, I had two questions. One goes back to the pneumonia. We receive a lot of skilled nursing facility patients here, and you said the community standard didn't fit. Was it just the addition of the fluoroquinolone?
Well, I think the most important point related to skilled nursing facilities is, as we all know, there's not only one type of skilled nursing facility.
Mm-hmm.
A type that has more ambulatory, more independent patients tends to have bacteria that are more like community acquired. One that is closely allied with a hospital, one that has acute care in the facility, one that gives IV antibiotics, tends to have organisms much closer to hospital acquired. And that was the setting I was referring to. And in those cases, the addition of the quinolone allows us to, number one, give the patient appropriate treatment, but also then we're in agreement with the IPRO performance indicators. If these people are treated strictly as nosocomial infection, remember the IPRO indicators refer to community-acquired infection.
Right.
And patients admitted from a nursing home are scored as community-acquired. So that's why adding the quinolone means we're treating them as per the protocol, but we're also treating them appropriately because we add to that the agents we would use for nosocomial infection.
Okay, I understand. And could you just go over the four W's again?
Sure, four W's, and some people would say it's five. But the first one is wind, which refers to atelectasis.
Mm-hmm.
Second is water, which refers to UTI. Third is wound, which is obvious wound infection. The fourth one is walk, which refers to deep venous thrombosis. And some people would say the fifth is wonder drugs, because certainly any drug can cause fever. But those encompass the overwhelming majority of causes of early post-op fever.
Okay, great. That's wonderful for teaching. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Again, if you do have a question or if you have a follow-up question, please press star 1 to signal. As a reminder, if you're using a speakerphone, please be sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. And we'll go next to Linda Green of Rochester General Hospital.
Yes, my question relates to surgical prophylaxis, particularly in those patients who are allergic to penicillin. One of our struggles is getting the vancomycin started in the appropriate time frame, and even though there's a two-hour window, it sometimes makes it very difficult. I wonder if you would comment on whether or not you started in surgery. The argument would be that maybe the whole dose is not infused by the time the operation starts.
Okay, so 2 points I'd like to make about that. The first one relates to allergy itself. Now, remember, half of the people who tell us they're allergic to penicillin are not. So it's very important to find out what the allergy is. If someone got a stomach ache when they took a penicillin pill, obviously they're not allergic and it's safe to give a cephalosporin. Similarly, if someone has a non-anaphylactic allergy to penicillin, most commonly a rash, there's a 3%, not 10%, a 3% chance they'll get a rash from a cephalosporin. And in that case, the cephalosporin should be given also. Now, a question has come up which relates to your saying, what's the shortest time? Because we say give it within 1 hour preoperatively. Well, does that mean we can give it 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 1 minute preoperatively? The answer is any of those is probably okay, because once the blood has circulated around the body once, there's enough drug at the site of incision for it to be effective. So with vancomycin, ideally, the infusion should be completed prior to the initiation of surgery, even if that's completed 5 minutes before the surgery starts. But if the infusion is still running and most of the dose has gone in, that's probably adequate, although no official guideline would say to do it that way. Because remember, the vancomycin is effective as long as the level is above the trough level. So even if it hasn't quite reached peak, it still should be effective at preventing post-op infection. So ideally, the dose should be completed. Practically, if most of the dose has gone in, it's probably going to be okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We'll go next to Dr. Monica Gaton of Maimonides Med Center.
Oh. Hi. Hi, Dr. Travnik. Thank you for this wonderful presentation. I have a question that touches on the surgical prophylaxis. What do you tell the surgeon that has followed the surgical prophylaxis to the key, and then his patient gets transferred from recovery from the OR in a room with another patient that has some sort of an infection? That surgeon calls you and tells you, I'm not going to put my patient with a clean prosthetic joint or with a clean graft in the same room with a patient that has an UTI or a pneumonia. What do you answer?
That is an excellent question, and I'm sure it's one we all face every day, because if those of you didn't hear that questioner actually is from my institution. But in any event, we can try logic, although logic doesn't always work. And I'm sure all of us who do infection control have been faced with exactly this question. The key point here is the organisms that can cause post-op infections are airborne. And logically, we would love to be able to put every single patient in a single room so that they wouldn't be exposed to potential infections of other patients. But we can't start making exceptions by saying post-op patients can't go with someone who has an infection. Then the oncologist will say they don't want their patients with someone with infection. And unfortunately, most of us don't have a large number of private rooms. So the best answer I could give to that question is we have to try and be logical and try and say we won't put patients in the same room, people with things that are spread by the airborne route. But we really have to draw the line and say we can't be keeping every patient who has had surgery separate from every patient in the hospital who has an infection. That's just not feasible.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Once again, that's star one if you have a question or a follow-up question. It appears there are no further questions at this time.
Dr. Chapnick, hi, this is Dr. Stimler. Actually, I have one question. I had gotten a comment from a hospital that confused me a bit, where they had said that they were not discontinuing their prophylaxis within 24 hours because, according to them, the American Dental Association recommendation for prophylaxis in high-risk patients required continuation of the prophylaxis for 48 hours, although I frankly have not been able to find that recommendation anywhere. I wonder, does that make any sense to you? Have you heard of that at any time, or do you perhaps have an idea of what the hospital might have been getting confused with?
Well, the first thing, I guess the first distinction we need to make is between endocarditis prophylaxis and wound infection prophylaxis. So the Dental Association guidelines generally refer to endocarditis prophylaxis, but even those guidelines used to say give one dose before the procedure and one dose 6 hours later. Those, at least the ones from the American Heart Association, have been changed to say just give one pre-procedure dose. And they've eliminated the post-procedure dose, even from the endocarditis prophylaxis recommendations related to dental work. So I haven't seen this 48-hour recommendation, and even before they changed the guidelines, the old guidelines for dental work just said one post-op dose. So all I would do is ask these people where these guidelines come from, and I'd like to see them because I'm not aware of that.
Thank you. That's very helpful because I think they may have been mistaken, but they were looking to quote what they felt was the most conservative guidelines, given that their patients had they were looking at orthopedic patients with prosthetic implants, so that's kind of why they were looking at the ADA guidelines. But I also could not find any support for that 48 hours.
Right, as I said, I have never seen a recommendation like that, and I'd certainly be interested to see it if it exists, but I'm not aware of any.
Deanna, could you ask one more time if there are any additional questions, please?
Yes, ma'am. Again, if you have a question, please press star followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone phone to signal. And we do have two more questions. We'll go first to Cindy Pignow of St. Charles Hospital.
Yes, hi. I have a question regarding the pneumococcal vaccination. Are orthopedic surgeons are hesitant to give the pneumococcal vaccine for fear of the patient becoming febrile and not being able to distinguish between a post-op infection and the vaccination? Is there any helpful hints or anything you could give me so that I could bring this back to the physicians?
Well, in a patient who has a very short hospital stay, mm-hmm. that is someone who's being admitted for surgery, going home the next day, it is, it's an argument that's hard to answer in that case, except to say the febrile reaction that occurs from the vaccine tends to be very mild and very self-limited. That is, it goes away in 24 hours or less. But if it's something that's very soon postoperatively, it's reasonable in those cases to say, okay, we can defer it, let their doctor give it to them in a week. But in the patients who have longer hospital stays than a day or two, that's why we give the vaccine at discharge. If they're now a week post-op, mm-hmm. they haven't had a fever in that time frame. If a vaccine gives a few hours of fever, it's not really going to confuse things very much.
Mm.
But it would be reasonable in a case like that, in our order pathway or in anyone's, to say vaccine contraindicated now because I'm worried this is day one post-op and I don't want to see a fever, but I will give it a week from now at their first follow-up visit.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And again, that's star one if you would like to have a question, a follow-up, or a comment. And we'll go now to Jean Marshall of North Central Bronx Hospital.
Yes, Dr. Chapnick?
Yes.
My question is about the oral prophylaxis for colon surgery. Is that also a required guideline to give erythromycin and neomycin 18 hours prior to colon surgery?
Well, I don't like to use a requirement. It's more like a recommendation.
A recommendation.
But yes, for colon surgery, it is recommended to give both the
erythromycin.
The oral prep as well as an IV dose.
I see. No, because we're participating in this study by iPro, and I'm just wondering if this is part of our indicator number one to follow as a recommendation.
Yeah,
or so,
I have to qualify that by saying I'm not entirely sure, and Dr. Stimler can answer this, I'm sure, whether that is specifically in the iPro performance indicator.
Mm-hmm.
I know it is generally recommended and generally practiced by most surgeons to do both.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to be clear on that because we're doing that surveillance on these different data. And before I start, you know, finalizing my first quarter, I want to make sure that that's also one of the recommendations that we have to follow.
Okay, Dr. Stimler, are you on?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, I believe that the oral prophylaxis is included in the in the guidelines. And as far as the timing is concerned, there's an exception. Or if you're giving that oral prophylaxis, obviously it ends much sooner.
Mm-hmm.
That's taken into account.
Okay, another question about this iPro 2 is the patients who are receiving therapeutic antibiotics prior to surgery, and then when they classify the wound classification, they classified it as clean contaminated. And this group of patients, do we include in these numbers or we exclude them?
Well, anyone who has an existing infection or an infection that is diagnosed postoperatively is generally removed from the denominator, so they're not in the sample where indicator calculations are made.
So you have to wait for that diagnosis of infection postoperatively to exclude them, or do you make that decision prior to, meaning preoperatively with infection, you exclude them?
Well, certainly anyone who comes in with an infection is excluded from the denominator.
Right. But it's not always the case, though. They just give therapeutic antibiotics so that when it's the time for surgery, they don't give that 1 hour prior or within an hour prior to incision. So we kind of exclude those people from those numbers. And that, do you agree with that?
Well, I'm not entirely sure I understand what that last question was, but
all right. No, the therapeutic antibiotics was given prior to the incision,
right,
so that when
therapeutic generally implies that it's not prophylactic that you're giving
Right. So we exclude them.
So they are excluded,
even though they're classified as clean contaminated after the surgery.
That point is irrelevant if they have a pre-existing and it just
All right. No, it's just it's so unclear, you know, sometimes whether the patient has the real infection or not.
Right. Now, that's not to say that those patients probably wouldn't benefit from appropriately timed antibiotic prophylaxis.
Mm-hmm.
Just that those, because there are additional, you know, complicating issues with, you know, in terms of trying to get ideal patients, you generally want, when you're looking at these guidelines and calculating indicators, to look at a subset of patients that are considered to be ideal, meaning they have pretty much straightforward cases that don't have any other clinical situations that might confuse the issue.
Right.
So,
unfortunately, colon surgery is one of them that's very hard to differentiate sometimes. Yeah. Okay.
Therapeutically, one very important point, you know, whether or not they're included in the survey, I want to reemphasize what Dr. Stimler just said, that even if someone is on therapeutic antibiotics for anything else, they still should get that preoperative dose within the one-hour time frame, because otherwise it won't be effective at preventing the post-op wound infection.
Yes, okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Thank you. We do have another question from Dolores Arbucci of Our Lady of Mercy Medical Center.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for the presentation today.
My pleasure.
I was wondering if you could comment on the effectiveness of antibiotics that are used for wound irrigation during surgery. Does it complement the pre-op antibiotics, and if there are any that you feel are better than others?
Well, the last time I looked into this, which was actually within the past year or so, I couldn't find any evidence in the literature of any benefit of intraoperative antibiotic irrigation or antibiotic infusion or anything like that. So I know many surgeons do that, but I'm just not aware of any data supporting its effectiveness, and you know, therefore I certainly can't say which agent, if any, is better at that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, and we'll give everyone one final chance to signal by pressing star 1 on their touch-tone phone. We'll pause just a moment. And there are no further questions at this time. I'd like to turn the call back to Ms. Denise Faulkner-Cameron for any additional or closing remarks.
At this time, we'd like to thank everyone once again and thank Dr. Chapnick for his very informative and detailed presentation. And thank you to all of our participants who joined us for the call, as well as those who shared their questions and comments. Before we conclude the call this morning, we'd just like to remind you of a couple of things. First of all, again, on the Jenny website underneath the presentation slides for Dr. Chapnick is the evaluation form, and we'd like to ask all of our participants to just take a few moments to complete the form and return it to us as soon as possible, as it provides us with useful information and feedback. There's a fax number where you can fax the form, or if you'd like to complete it electronically, you can do so and email it to me at dfaulkner, D-F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R, at nyqio.sdps.org. We'll also like to remind you of our next call, which is scheduled for March 15th at 11 a.m., where we're going to be discussing the topic of spread. And this is as we are moving into the last phase of the collaborative, where a lot of the system changes that you have implemented at your institutions, you're now assessing their effectiveness and beginning to spread them to your other populations. So we're going to be discussing that and the importance of senior leadership buy-in in instituting the concept of spread. At this time, thank you once again, and information on subsequent calls will be forthcoming, and we'd like to remind you to keep checking the Jenny website for all updates. Again, thank you very much for joining us, and everyone, have a good day.
Thank you for your participation. That does conclude today's call, and you may disconnect at this time.